Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
All right. Welcome back, everyone, for another episode of the Voices in Courage podcast. I'm going to be leading the conversation today with K.L. Wells. And today we're going to shift gears a little bit. And K.L. and I have been talking about this for quite some time, and we definitely feel like it's a topic that needs to be heard, discussed, embraced. We could probably come up with about 50 verbs to attach to it, but today we want to dive into it a little bit more. And you said something, K.L., that I really like, the fact that shame and judgment are alive and well in the halls of corporate America. Mm-hmm. And when we think about that, we're going to dive into some more behind that, especially around the conversations we're not having in the workplace, whether they're silent, whether they're not happening at all, whether they're taboo. We're going to get into that today, and I'm excited to discuss that.
Me too.
Welcome back, KL.
Thank you.
To the podcast. One thing I wanted to start with is, and you know, I'm a little bit of a research geek when it comes down to thinking about things and frameworks for topics and so forth. I'm going to geek out a little bit on some research that Mental Health America puts out every year, and it's their basically mental health in the workplace. And it is incredibly telling, but also I think very insightful in we have the data. Mm-hmm. Are we having the conversations to back the data up?
Great question.
Well, it's one thing to have it.
Yep.
Fantastic. Those insights allude to things that we need to be discussing, but we're probably not doing it the right way. So real quick, some of those findings, and we'll dive right into, I have a question for you, and we'll take it from there. As we're going through the pandemic, 65% of Americans alone, 65% in 2020 started looking for a new job. Mm-hmm. The highest rate of job search since the dot-com explosion, 9/11. Mm-hmm. And only 20% actually said they found purpose and delight in what they do. Mm-hmm. So we're in a system right now where that's 80% of our population does not feel fulfilled, satisfied, excited, motivated, purposefully driven in what they do. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we've talked about this. You've heard the Great Resignation, all of these kinds of things. But what we're not talking about are some of the mental health figures and specifically substance abuse figures that are coming out of it. One in four men are addicted to some sort of substance abuse. Mm-hmm. It used to be one in seven women. That is dropping down to one and five and a half, so almost five. Mm-hmm. So the gender gap in usage and abuse is shrinking rather rapidly. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see a lot of, because of hybrid remote workforce dynamics, I think there was some number that came out that was like 30% of women had to exit the corporate workforce to go and do some sort of blended remote, the house, the whole thing. Now that's shifting back, but now you're finding a lot of women like, now what? Kids are back in school. So there's these kind of uncertain unknowns, but what it is it's shining a spotlight on some of these conversations that we're not happy. And
today
we're suffering as a nation. So I'd love
to throw a couple more statistics in there. Okay, so one in three American families are dealing with alcoholism or addiction.
Yeah.
One in three. And the statistics that you referenced earlier relative to 20% really feel fulfilled by their jobs, that's not just COVID. That was happening prior to COVID, but COVID now shone a spotlight on the unrest, the unhappiness, the lack of fulfillment, the lack of meaning in a dramatic way that now people are starting to pay attention to. I've been talking about these statistics for years with the corporate companies that I work with, the execs that I work with, and have been working with them to create compassionate cultures.
Yep.
And it's going to be fascinating to watch what companies decide to wake up and what don't.
Mm-hmm.
because we are now in the throes of chaos.
Yeah.
And COVID was a catalyst for the chaos, and we are going to continue to be in the throes of chaos.
Yeah.
So you throw a whole 300 million people into the chaos machine, and what do you get? You get people who are ill-prepared to navigate. And so they reach for the easiest things, the easy buttons, so to speak, of addiction, alcoholism, drugs, shopping, all the things. So they don't have to deal with or develop the skill sets to navigate the chaos. And yes, and I think personally, those statistics are not clear representations of what really is going on. I don't know if you walk around your neighborhood. I walk around my neighborhood on trash days, and I see the containers filled with bottles.
Yeah.
Because that is generally their coping mechanism.
Yeah.
And I was talking to a colleague the other day about, there's a podcast out there called The Huberman Lab, and he's a neuroscience researcher out of Stanford, super brilliant. He does these really long podcasts. And this colleague of mine was talking about having watched a podcast in terms of the effects of alcoholism. And we tend to think about alcoholism in particular as, oh, we have a few drinks and then we sleep it off.
Yeah.
What we don't think about is the cumulative effect over weeks, months, and years, which is staggering in terms of our mental health, in terms of our brain health, in terms of our physical health, and our emotional health, our spiritual health, all of the things. And so we have a population that is ill-informed, and therefore we have these C-suite execs that are ill-informed themselves. The other statistic that is remarkable to me is, and I found this to be true last week when I met with one of my companies, 50% of our employees are walking into work every day with something that's taking place at home that is distracting them at work.
Yeah.
And how do you think they're handling the distractions?
Yeah. I'll add one thing to that, Kale.
Yeah.
It's over 70% don't feel safe enough to have a conversation or feel supported in the workplace to deal with it.
Right, exactly.
So they have to separate church and state, which creates even more unrest within the brain.
Correct. And the truth of the matter is, every exec that walks into work every day is a human being too. And that's where the conversations really need to be taking place, is we need to have C-suites and executives at the highest echelons of corporate America waking up, not only to what's going on in their workforces, but in their own lives. There are a ton of C-suites that are full of alcoholics and addicts, and they're not talking about it.
Yeah.
Because there's still so much shame and judgment around this.
Yeah.
It is not recognized as the disease that it is.
Yeah.
There's the moral overlay. There's the judgment. Why can't you just quit? There is the, if we don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. And the shame is so pervasive. That it's actually killing us.
There's a story that you have, it's recent, that I think everyone should hear, that touches on that very notion that we still can't talk about it. A door starts to open, someone comes right around the corner and goes, oh, I don't want to see that. Slam it. Talk a little bit about that experience you just had.
Well, I'd spent quite a number of months teeing up being able to speak at a corporate event. And as far as I knew, we had teed all the T's up and dotted all the I's and all the things were in place and I had to go and so on and so forth. And at the last minute, it was a no-go because the powers that be up above the decision makers that I was dealing with nixed it because we're still not talking about this.
Yeah.
And I was shocked and not shocked. Yeah. Disappointed, I would say, for sure.
Yeah.
That in this day and time, when so many people are dealing with this and there are so many people keeping it hidden in corporate America, in C-suites and CEO positions and all the decision makers, it is pervasive. I mean, CEOs in and of themselves have a 50% chance of having depression higher than everybody else. How do you think they're navigating this?
Yeah.
And I understand we're no longer in the 50s and 60s and 70s where the madman era is alive and well.
Right.
We're in a very different era. And these things impact the bottom line at such a tremendous impact that, again, why aren't we talking about this? And so this is the evolution, I believe, in terms of emotional intelligence, compassionate cultures, in understanding that people are dealing with these diseases, whether it's themselves or whether it's a spouse or a child or a sister or a brother. I mean, I grew up with a mom. I grew up with a brother. I married an alcoholic, subsequently divorced him. I have a son who is a recovering addict. I am now married to an almost 30-year recovering alcoholic. So I had my own work to do to continue to up-level who I was in relationship with and how to navigate. And I've been very open with my clients and the people that I work with about my journey through this so that they would feel like they had permission to also share theirs.
Yeah.
And to a person, I cannot think right now of one person that does not know my story that has not had a story of their own.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you brought that up because one of the things that reminds me of in going back down to the, what are the basics that we need to start that are going to help drive conversation without it being finger pointing or feeling, again, shameful or judgmental. I go back to the years. I am an open recovery anxiety individual that I dealt with it for many years, but the way I dealt with it was my own alcoholic behavior. We don't have the education on the conversation or even the right language. We go back just 15 years ago, maybe even just 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I remember growing up with so much anxiety and all I heard was stop worrying so much. The same way when someone is going through real deep depression, why are you so sad? Mm-hmm. You need to be sad. Look at all the stuff that you have. Stop being so sad. It's this culture where we don't understand the physiology and the neurology behind it. And we're still in that space now with addiction where it's like, it's a choice. And it's a disease. So that whole, starting with that educational foundation, that language, we have to start somewhere, but we're not teaching it.
Yeah.
You only hear about it or we hear about it if somebody in your family or you're going through it, whatever it is, we don't talk about it enough. So well, part of it is going back to bottom line education.
Yes. And you have to choose to want to learn, to see it differently than what you have been told. That's how Voices in Courage got born was because I'm an avid learner. Just by who I am. And so I just kept reading books and watching videos and continuing to consume information that is the leading edge relative to brain science and trauma research and all the things that kind of swirl around this disease to come to my conclusion that my son isn't a bad person. And shaming him, guilting him, yelling him, all the things that I see a lot of parents do to try to guilt their child or their adult child or their spouse, guilt them, shame them, judge them into, quote, getting fixed.
Yeah.
So I can feel better and get back to my life is an absolutely failed strategy.
Yeah.
And most people don't know that. So it is first opening up to there might be a different story here.
Yeah.
And are you open to exploring and learning what actually is really going on?
Yeah.
And if we can just get to the point where we are open to learning.
Yeah.
And hearing and listening.
And I think it's also just challenging and or reframing the current paradigm. I mean, I remember one of the most simple yet powerful things that I was told. You mentioned it or alluded to it. It's not bad people doing bad things. Mm-hmm. It's sick people trying to get healthy.
Right.
And that was a really powerful statement in the sense of when you look at somebody who's sick trying to get medicine, sometimes the medicine works, sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. But when it's bad medicine, oftentimes we choose to ignore it and we try to look for the good medicine. I mean, there's so many analogies that we can go through, but I think part of it is so many people just don't want to look in the mirror. How many times even in corporations, if something goes wrong, but we don't want to look in the mirror. Let's just go ahead and put that underneath the carpet and try and move on and forget about crisis management. Let's just move forward.
I think there is a tremendous amount of denial that it exists at the level that it exists.
Yep.
And I think people who are ill-equipped to really navigate this would rather just turn a blind eye until sometimes it becomes personal to you.
Yep.
And with one in three American families dealing with this, it's probably coming your way in some right. form or fashion. There are very few people. You remember back when I was growing up, you would find people who had cancer, and then you'd find more people that had cancer. And pretty soon, cancer became like a regular thing.
Yeah.
And when my brother was diagnosed with cocaine addiction, I don't remember talking to anyone in my circle that was dealing with this or was willing to admit it.
Yep.
And so now when I talk to people, as soon as I tell my story and open the door for others to tell their stories, there's story after story after story after story, particularly with the opioid pandemic and now fentanyl crisis that we're dealing with. And so we've hit such a level of crisis that's at a magnitude that people either don't want to see
yeah.
or they don't understand and they want to turn a blind eye and they want to judge and they want to shame until it becomes their own issue.
Yeah, you're right. And I think what I'd like to do is we've identified, I think, where some of these pain points are and where, let's call it, state of the office is. But let's pretend mm-hmm. that a C-suite executive comes to us and says, mm-hmm. I know it's a problem. Mm-hmm. I've not addressed it. Mm-hmm. And it's not because I don't want to. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to. Mm-hmm. Where do you think, and let's talk a little bit about moving into solution-based thinking, where do we help yeah. C-suite executives start? Where do we think, like if we talk about an evolutionary process, yes, we've identified a problem, but where do I start?
Mm-hmm. First, I think it's at home. Mm. Honestly, I don't know any CEO at this point or president of a company that does not know someone. And so I want to know their story first, because I do actually really believe that when it becomes personal and they have the ability to actually share their own story, then yeah. there's a different window in. The conversation takes on a level of magnitude and vulnerability that I personally believe is really important to kind of be in the mix of. And I have worked with and talked about and trained on how do you hold the space
yeah.
without judgment and with no personal agenda to be able to hear those kinds of stories
yeah.
so that people feel safe psychologically. And that's the first step.
Yeah.
If I have a CEO and everybody who works with me at this point with any length of time understands that psychologically they're safe. And yeah. so I hear all kinds of things. And so that's the first thing, is create psychological safety.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because I had a conversation with a gentleman, 6 months ago, in his 70s, been in corporate America his entire life, retired in corporate America and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, we were talking a little bit about public speaking and what he's done in the past. I said, you know, if you had 3 minutes to give a business talk and you were on the floor of NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange or something, mm-hmm. what would you say? And he would say, I do believe that the Fortune 500 are going to fail. Mm-hmm. And it's not because of a lack of business or a lack of product innovation or a lack of vision. It's a lack of understanding the next generation of leadership and people mm-hmm. that are going to be helping serve your industry, particularly some of these newer generations. Mm-hmm. They're used to growing up in these safer places. They're used to having more honest conversation. We're going to start to see a shift from mm-hmm. the bottom up instead mm-hmm. of the top down. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a wave of, when we challenge the paradigm, it's mm-hmm. going to be down here that's going to be shifting and pushing upwards for that mm-hmm. conversation to happen. It's not going to be top down.
And absolutely. I mean, I've been having these conversations for a number of years now. It's like, look, you can sell the heck out of your product or whatever it is you've got going on, mm-hmm. business development, blah, blah, blah. But if you don't have a workforce,
yeah.
what are you going to do?
Happy workforce.
Well, if you have an unhappy workforce, now they've been given permission to leave you.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening, is COVID gave people the opportunity to reflect yeah. and think about their lives and then say, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, I honest to God just had a conversation with a neighbor Saturday and hates her job.
Yeah.
Like, her boss, who is the owner of the company, is just a witch. And she's like, what do I do? And I said, in this workforce and what's going on collectively now in the work world, you don't have to put up with that.
Yeah.
you can opt out. And so that was a really interesting conversation to give her permission to leave a job where she's crying at her desk every day because of this terrible boss.
Yeah.
I was just going to say,
I'm working with a younger gentleman and he had a very similar situation and he's only in his 20s. And he's like, I'm at this point now where I know I need the experience. I know I'm not the smartest person in the room. I never want to be the smartest person in the room, but I completely disagree with the way it's being run. Mm-hmm. So he walked into the office and basically his manager, who is a C-level person, said, I think we're doing this the wrong way. He challenged it and mm-hmm. said, I think we should do it. And they said, no. And basically he threatened to quit. And what the guy said was, well, you need us more than we need you.
Nope.
And then he looked at him and said, oh my gosh, I've never thought I would have to do this, but I'm going to quit on the spot. And the guy goes, well, what are you going to do? He's like, I'm going to go do it on my own and I'm going to do it better. And I was like, whoa, when you think about, okay, that's not an entitled issue. That's I'm following. No. And that was part of it was, you know, you have this entitled young millennial coming in here, blah, blah, blah. He's like, no, I just want to do things for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. So we're going to start to see that shift. And I think more of the conversation is going to be forced upon. Otherwise, they're going to lose talent. They're not going to be able to find good talent. And all of a sudden, here's the other thing that I hear is companies are being judged not necessarily on what they're producing as much as why they're doing it. And is it a great place to work at? Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, that thing that used to be at the bottom is like one of America's great places to work is now closer to the top. They want to know there's a culture fit before mm-hmm. anything else. They'll invest mm-hmm. in culture first before money.
So, yeah. And so
I think that's going to be a shift.
Well, it is a shift. We're in the shift right now. This has been talked about for at least mainstream for at least 5 to 10 years. There's a great book called The Evolved Enterprise by Yannick Silver. And I think he wrote it 5 years ago or so. And the premise of the book is that in the next 10 years, the business imperative is going to be your business needs to be about more than just making money. It actually needs to have some positive, significant social impact that serves people and the planet. And we're watching it catalytically rise. The hockey stick is beginning to take place relative to that imperative, which is driven by people who have a different paradigm mm-hmm. around what matters in the world as a society and as a planet. And so it's all connected here in terms of sticking your head in the sand relative to addiction and alcoholism. It's all the same thing.
Yeah.
Is we need to be having conversations about the social fabric that's taking place right now.
Yeah.
And the pandemic of addiction and alcoholism is one of the major red flags that our society is raising that's saying this isn't working.
Yeah.
And the fact that still the majority of corporate America is putting their head in the sand because they don't want to see it, they're going to be the ones that are not here in 10 to 20 years.
Yeah. I think too, part of it is, and I agree, I think let's start at home, right? Understand it and get practice with an understanding some of the storytelling behind it, but also feeling the feelings, going through what you need to go through in order to show up authentically at work. Because if you can't show up authentically, it's the conversation's not going to happen. I think the other thing, honestly, is really taking a courageous leap of faith.
Yes.
And understanding that employees want to be seen and heard. They want to feel safe. They want to feel as though they're in an environment where they can be held and they aren't just a workhorses. So part of that is not being afraid to have the conversation, but jump into it. I was working with
it. So Tucker, that requires us to lead.
Yes.
That requires us to become leaders of leaders in having these vulnerable conversations that involve us personally, because that's where we get our credibility is when we tell our own stories mm-hmm. and then the doors open.
Yeah.
So,
and I agree.
We're going to tell a story.
One of the things I was going to say was all of the individuals that I work with today, mm-hmm. I didn't know 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. They didn't know me 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I know for a fact, 7 years ago, they wouldn't be working with me.
Right.
And I love the fact because most of my business development has come from storytelling and being mm-hmm. very honest and vulnerable.
Right.
And that understanding, that trust that's built immediately
yeah.
is so much more powerful than trying to prove a balance sheet.
Yes.
And it goes back to, as humans, we buy on emotion and justify with logic. And right now we have it completely backwards.
Yeah.
We're trying to create all this logical thinking and leaving the emotion out of it. And it's really hard to create that synergy, that trusted relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, to your point, how do we lead differently?
Mm-hmm.
We lead with a different voice. We lead, mm-hmm. again, it's instead of how many followers do we have, it's how can we lead with empathy so that people that do follow us are speaking the same language. And that's where the groundswell starts, is being able to adopt and speak and embrace the same language.
Yeah. And I do think by leading, giving other people permission to step into the truth about their own journey.
Yep.
I know that's my work, is to give people permission to tell the truth about their own life and what's really going on in their lives, so that they have at least one safe place. And a lot of my clients, I refer them on to counselors too, because I'm not a counselor, but I do hold the space for them from a, what we talk about is the difference between a therapeutic space and a therapy space. I'm the therapeutic mm-hmm. space. I love my clients and they know it. And they know that they're safe with me because a lot of them know my story already too. And they know that I'm going to be genuine and authentic with them and reserve whatever judgment that they're getting from the outside world. I don't live in the world of shame and blame. And so to have a safe place like that, where that is just not part of the room that we sit in, is super powerful. And part of my work is training those execs so that they can create those spaces for their employees. And meeting I had last week, and this is a manufacturing company, okay? So I'm meeting with two of the execs that come in, COO, CEO, and they walk in and they go, our employees are having crises all over the place. And it's not a large company, but 50% of their employees, they had a story for each one of them. Wife with cancer, wife who just lost a baby. I mean, it just kept going on and on. And what I loved about it was I've been working with them for about 6 years. They created a safe enough place where their employees could tell their stories. So they knew what was going on. Now they're wanting to know, okay, how else do we support them in the midst of these crises that they're dealing with while also running a company? And so anyway.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I have a very similar story. I was working with a woman. She's a team director at Microsoft, very male-dominated industry, but she was a woman leading the team of eight. And she said it was so dysfunctional, she wanted to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what was making it dysfunctional? Lack of trust, finger pointing, people not communicating well, the whole thing. And I said, well, tell me a story. She goes, mm-hmm. what do you mean? I said, tell me a story in your life that changed the trajectory of where you are today or that had the greatest influence. And she started talking about her nonverbal daughter at 21 years old. She's never spoken a word.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, are you comfortable sharing more about you to your team? And she goes, yes, absolutely. So she has eight people. So I said, for 8 weeks, you rotate each team member for the first 5 minutes of your weekly meeting. They tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
She got up there and told her story and a woman started to cry.
Yeah.
And she goes, I have a nonverbal son.
Oh.
And all of a sudden, I mean, I still yep. get the chills when I hear this.
Right.
The entire thing changed. Mm-hmm. Another gentleman got up there and said, if I weren't here today, I'd be snowboarding. Every single day I'd be snowboarding. He's now snowboarding with one of the other team members. And all it took was 5 minutes out of their day.
Right.
Productivity went up. Right. Workplace satisfaction went up. Mm-hmm. Their numbers went up. And all of a sudden, she went in for a review. Like, what are you doing differently? We're telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
Changing the dialogue, changing the language, changing the narrative. And mm-hmm. that changed the entire thing. I mean, imagine if we just started having those vulnerable conversations and opening up. That's what it does.
Well, this is the power of social connection.
Yeah.
And at work, generally speaking, corporate America has not figured this out, is that social connection in a way that matters, like these stories that you just relayed, it matters that we know who each one of us is.
Yeah.
What matters to us most.
Yeah.
So when I start working with companies and I have the opportunity to work with the C-suite, one of the very first things I do is I have each one of them tell what they love to do in their free time.
Yep.
And I will always invariably ask, did anybody know this?
Yeah.
And they go, no.
Yep.
And so once the windows are in into who we are as human beings, and we recognize each other as a human being and somebody who loves their family and backpacking or snowboarding, or they've got a child who is nonverbal, all these things, it drops the veneer of a job title.
Yeah.
I own three businesses. I'm not just a CEO.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a person first.
Yeah.
Exactly. So these are all ways to allow for the social connections to happen that are really built on authenticity and genuineness.
Yeah.
And how to have conversations with people. And what I'm finding is, obviously, there are going to be people who do not want to do this. And I know some of these people, not for long.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't work with them. But when they're ready, I am open to a conversation. The ones that are willing to think about this differently and really understand what's going on. And then it frees them personally to be a different type of leader that actually is more aligned, with who they are as a human being.
Yep. So let's wrap up with, what would be a parting comment to an executive or a C-level individual right now? What would you leave them with if they've listened to this podcast?
I would say first and foremost is think about your own life and your own stories.
Mm-hmm.
And multiply that by the number of execs that you work with or the number of employees that you have.
Yeah.
Everybody has a story.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are the type of leader who is willing to have the courage to lead in a different way and be vulnerable to share a story, the transformation of yourself, your execs, and your company is going to blow your mind.
Yeah.
And given the fact of the societal issues that we're dealing with now, it is a business imperative.
Yeah.
You no longer get the choice to turn a blind eye.
Yeah.
To be cold and reserved and don't care.
Yeah.
Because at some point, you will not have a workforce to create the wealth that you think you want.
Yeah. I'll add one little thing to that. I love the way you said that, is start connecting people to people instead of people to the work.
Yes.
Because when you start connecting people to people, the work will find them. Mm-hmm. And I find that so often that they're pushing people more productivity, more of this, this or that, connect to the work, connect. Mm-hmm. They're not connecting to one another. Mm-hmm. And we talk about that emotional, there's can be emotional intimacy at work in a way that's very productive and very healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But we're so focused on work well-being that we're not focused on employee workplace well-being.
So, yeah. Well, and the paradigm has to shift is work well-being is no longer what you thought it was.
Yeah.
Work well-being is when you have employee well-being.
Yeah.
So we have got to change the story and be open to changing the story and exploring what's actually really taking place here. And I think it takes courage.
It does. And that's
And so I encourage all my execs, recognize the courage that it takes and figure out the skill set, because a lot of them need to learn the skills to be able to do the things that we're talking about here today. I didn't grow up knowing how to do this. No. This is all skill development on my part. And I continue to perfect those skills because I know the magnitude and importance of that as a human being, but also as a coach and exec and somebody who wants to make a dent in the universe.
Yeah. And rather than fear it, celebrate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because what happens is once you free yourself, you free yourself.
Yeah.
It's such an extraordinary feeling to not have to put on the armor, not have to put on the facade, not have to do all the dancing to the right, dancing to the left that goes along with it. It's totally freeing.
Welcome to freedom.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Kale, thank you for the conversation today. I think we need more of it. Let's just agree that this is part one in a series of more conversations, but these are the conversations that we want to have and start to create more of a groundswell within the workplace. So thank you for being honest and open and telling more of your story as we continue to learn on how we can best serve our community. So thank you all for listening, and we will all talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Tucker, for teeing this up. This was a really rich conversation. And yes, we'll do this again.
All right. Take care, everyone.
All right. You too.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.